Hello, discerning podcast listeners. This is Tom Kenny, and you are listening to the Geekcast Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to episode 212 of the Cinema Geeks. I am one of your Cinema Geeks, Optimus Solo, and joining me today once again is the Comic Concierge. Dan, how are we doing?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. I'm excited to get into yet another Hitchcock film. It's weird. We've been making our way through this 10 films of Alfred Hitchcock, kind of a lot of 8 blind spots for me, a few blind spots for you, but just a chance to kind of look at this iconic director and all of these things. And we were trying to decide in the beginning, obviously Hitchcock has like 1,000 films. We were trying to decide how many would be a good number and things of that nature. And you feel like you get through about 10 films of somebody and you're probably thinking that'll be enough and like you're going to be ready to move on to something. I can honestly say that I'm somewhat like motivated to even watch more of Hitchcock films than the ones we have. I'm like, oh, but we're not watching this one, so-and-so is also in this one. I wonder what that one's like. So it's kind of crazy. I'm definitely not getting tired of this journey at all. So what's your take so far as we've made this journey, and what were you going into today as far as thought process as we were going to cover the 1959 spy thriller North by Northwest?
It was actually very similar because I was looking through, because there is a lot, obviously we're not covering, he's, like you mentioned, it was in the age where he made a movie a year, if not more, so you can't do them all, and even with him, like, there was some major ones that, you know, like, we are missing, and it does make me think maybe going back and seeing a few, especially with some of the actors that I've really enjoyed that he did other movies with, I'm like, maybe, mm-hmm. you know, so I was actually feeling similarly, I'm like, I might go back and watch, for example, like Lifeboat and other ones I've seen before, some new ones, because like now they're popping up at like on different platforms about recommendations. I'm like, yeah, you know what, I haven't seen that one, maybe I should. As well as like you know, I remember the old Alfred, I know he didn't like direct most of them, but the old Alfred Hitchcock Presents TV show,
yes,
back in the day. But yeah, so I've been really enjoying it. Obviously we didn't love every single film, which is going to happen no matter, you know, what filmography you go through, for the most right. part. But even like the movies I didn't love, there's always something. I was glad I watched it. So
yeah, for sure. I haven't been upset about any of them necessarily. Yeah. One of them that catches my mind is that has been thrown out there a couple times as I've been doing research for it is To Catch a Thief, which is the 1955 film, and that's got Cary Grant and Grace Kelly in it. And that's one I've never seen before. So that's definitely something that I'm like, oh, I'd like to see these two on stage together again. So, just one of many that I've been like, well, maybe there's going to be a part two at some point. I don't know. So yeah. what was your history once again for North by Northwest? What were you bringing as far as when you were venturing into this rewatch for you, I believe, and how long had it been?
Been a while. I think I first watched it when it first came to Blu-ray. Remember buying it or something like that, or maybe it was a special edition or something like that of Northwest. So it's been a while. It's been over like a decade since I've last seen it. I remember when I watched it last time, I remember really liking it, but and remembering some bits of it, but still a lot of it, you know, has long gone my memory. So
absolutely, and it was like I said last episode, is the first time watch for me. So this is a 1959 film starring Cary Grant, Eva Marie Saint, and James Mason. It is a tale of mistaken identity as an innocent man is pursued across the United States, in this instance, by agents trying to prevent him from, or that he's trying to prevent blocking their plan to smuggle microfilm containing government secrets out of the country. So this is like part 39 Steps, part Notorious, part of a lot of the different films that we have watched so far all together, it seems like, in one big package. So what was your initial take on this rewatch for you?
My initial take was that I still really enjoyed it a great deal. And I obviously before this was the time before like summer blockbusters existed, but I feel like people argue what is the biggest, you know, what's the first blockbuster. I feel like this could be added to the list because it is such a big film. especially for its day. Like, some of the set pieces in this are, I think, some of the most probably required some of the most work we've seen. Of course, the classic plane sequence that, you know, this is best known by, but even the Mount Rushmore scenes. But beyond that, I just think it's one of those movies that kind of has it all, in the sense of there's a lot of comedy in this. I completely forgot like how funny it is at times. Like, and a lot of that, of course, is from Cary Grant. Like the entire scene where, you know, he's driving drunk, and it's supposed to be terrifying, and it is, but it's also funny at the same time, just because of the way he plays it. And then the entire scene of him drunk being interviewed by the cops and stuff like that. It's like, oh, this is why he's such a legend, because it's so effortless. There's so many great lines in that. Like, you know, when he's like, stick out your tongue, he's like, okay, stand back. Or I could hear him say, Lester Towson. Like, I could just, like, the way he said that every time, like, I could listen to an entire movie of him just saying Lester Towson the entire time. Just the way he would present stuff. But I had a great time with this. And I think I even liked it more this time around. And, you know, it obviously, going through this retrospective, you see a lot of these things that, you know, Hitchcock loves. And I feel like there's so many of them in this movie. Like, as we've been going through all the Hitchcock isms, I feel like every check mark this one has, yes. And then some. So I don't know. I had a great time with it. How about yourself?
Well, I came in with no expectations. I didn't know exactly like what the mood of the film would be. Like, what, obviously a lot of his films have some similar takes as far as like the aesthetics of them and like what they're going for from a suspense or a thriller standpoint. And I'm reading that this one says like spy thriller, and I feel like the word comedy is missing from that description. Like, this, okay, this may not be, and some argue that this is the best Hitchcock film. I don't know if I'll say it's the best Hitchcock film in my opinion so far. I don't know if it'll come out as the favorite of or the best made or anything like that. But I know for sure, without going through all those exercises, that so far this is the most fun Hitchcock film I've experienced. Like, this is just entertaining from beginning to end. And it is hysterical. Like, I was not anticipating. Like, I knew I liked Cary Grant. Like, I've seen him in a number of different films. I know I'm a huge fan of his. Like, he's one of my favorite, like, Hollywood era actors. And for some reason, I had never seen this. And this is just like, I don't, like, this is like the top of the heap for him. Like, he is amazing in this film. Amanda and I were watching this together because she's joined me for most of this journey. She had studied a few of these in school and a few that she hadn't seen, so she's been watching and looking forward to certain ones. And we were watching this together and just absolutely cracking up like half the time. Like, the thing about that drunk sequence is it should look so terrible based on a lot of other things you see from this era when it comes to that type of thing, because they just didn't have the technology to really like pull that off. And it actually doesn't look bad. Like, it looks funny, but not like, I don't know. It doesn't have that thing where you're just like, well, that's just an old film, we got to like forgive it for like looking like it does right now. Like, I thought it looked pretty good with his whole sequence. He's hysterical when he's getting interviewed by the police. Like, when he crawls up and lays down on like the desk or whatever that is, that piece of furniture, yes. I was dying. And then like the sequences where he's in a car with his kidnappers, I guess you could say, like the nonchalant, the nothing can faze me.
Yeah.
The I have a quip for everything you're about to say. And like the just not taking anything serious. Like, he takes so many moments of this film not serious at all, that it's, yeah, just it's hilarious to watch. So like, I thoroughly enjoyed this film from beginning to end. And it is like you're talking about blockbuster wise, like the locations that they're going to, like the sequence with the plane, the sequence with Mount Rushmore, the sequence with the United Nations. Like, this is like the summer blockbuster, right? Like, you're getting all the different like bigger than life set pieces and things of that nature. It comes out the July 4th weekend in 1959, I believe. And this is just like, you have a movie star of all movie stars. You have all of these scenic and crazy set pieces. You have action, you have comedy. At the time, you know, the whole spy aspect going along with the Cold War and things of that nature. So like, I feel like it just works on so many levels. And I read this later that it has been printed multiple times. I did not know that. Like when we were just watching this without and doing any research, without looking at any websites, any reviews of, about any of this, we were like halfway through and I looked over at Amanda and I said, was Cary Grant the first James Bond? Like, because if he wasn't technically, I feel like he was some other way, because I feel like everything that James Bond is based off of this character in some way. Like he's dressed like to impress. I did read something after the fact that like his suit, I think GQ or something in 2006 assembled some panel to like talk about like the most influential costumes, outfits, clothing, things in like film. I don't know if it was in film history or whatever it was, but like his suit is like at one of the top of the list. They said that a couple of Tom Cruise in one of the films copied it. In Collateral, Ben Affleck and Paycheck has like basically the same suit. So like it's just hitting on all cylinders here, and I think it's just more fun and more funny than I was expecting to have with this film.
Yeah, and it's crazy how much like you could, when going through this, that not necessarily related to this, but the fact Cary Grant never won an Oscar for anything is crazy to me. Like he has like an honorary one, but like I don't know, like he's so good in this. And the James Bond comparison is pretty apt, because it is like that. You have a lot of these, I think some of the better set pieces than you saw in like James Bond for quite a while. Like the crop dusting scene, I think, is famous and for obvious reasons. Like I can only imagine, you know, the oops they had to jump through to get that to work as well as it does. It's always on the move. It doesn't waste really any time whatsoever. Like it starts and it, you know, I've mentioned like previous films that we've done, there's a lot, like a lot of patience in Hitchcock's film. Like even Rear Window, it takes a while for things to kind of build up. Like with this, by the first act, it's like it's off to the races. And it does like slow down a little bit after that after the drunk sequence, but not in like in a bad way. But then it goes right back up again. I just thought it was paced so well. And the characters here, you know, not to bash on Vertigo again or anything like that, but mentioned last week with Vertigo, like how, you know, that a lot of that movie is focused on this relationship working and, you know, you believing it. And I didn't have that feeling here. Certainly not the case. Like this, even though like on paper, it kind of looks a bit ludicrous that this woman would fall in love with this guy. Although there's, it was purposeful, you know, Eva Marie Saint and Cary Grant just had so much great chemistry. Like I bought them as a couple. Like you understood, like I felt believable to me, you know, they would do all the rounds that they did to do what they did. And it is a bit confusing, like on paper, like it does. I do think a second time around, I was able to better understand what was happening, but I at the same time, that confusion, I think, is helpful because you're always kind of trying to guess where it's going. And when it gets there, I also like that it doesn't try to overly explain everything. Like it hits at it. Like there's this, you know, statue with film in it. What's in that? It doesn't really get into it. It just, you know, it's the thing that they care about. And I love that about a lot of Hitchcock movies that we've gotten so far. It's like, he's the bad guy. You know, he's the bad guy. Why is he the bad guy? Because he's the bad guy. And some people could look at that as like not great script writing, but at times I just feel like, you know why this person is here. You know where this is going. We don't have to like, you know, spell it out. And I feel like, you know, a lot of movies today, we have to do that all the time. We have to go into explanations about everything. Here it's like, this is the thing they need to get because they need to get it. And that's enough. And I kind of like, I like that because you can spend it focused on the more fun things, the better things, more interesting things, rather than just like the MacGuffins that don't mean much anyways.
I didn't know that he was like one of the people that, I thought I read somewhere that he's one of the guys that coined that phrase.
Oh, really?
I didn't know. As something like used in film just for other purposes. I think I read one thing. I didn't look like substantiate it, but I guess that's a Hitchcock word possibly. I think another thing that it does that we saw, especially like right off the bat with the 39 steps, right? Like you know immediately that this guy's innocent. You know that he's being sought after in some type of way. So like you're immediately on board with him and in his corner, but then also like the suspense is just built in, even though we're having a ton of fun along the way. And he's not, he's taking it in a much different way, obviously, than the character does in the 39 steps. But it's just like, we already have the suspense about, is he going to be able, how is he going to be able to clear his name and things of that nature. But I think they do just enough along the way to keep us guessing and to keep us not expecting what happens next, right? Like there is the sequence done in the United Nations where I guess they had to employ some like hidden cameras to figure out like what that needed to look like, and then they had to recreate it. But anyways, there's an action that happens in that building as far as you think he's getting somewhere, and then a swerve, I guess, is sent through as far as like somebody's meeting their demise and whatnot. Like, did not see that coming. So there's different things along the way. Like, obviously, if you've seen it multiple times or if you've read stuff about it, none of this is gonna be like, you know, it's not gonna like catch you off guard or anything like that. But like, on a first time watch, you don't know who the real agent is, right? Like, at first, like they mentioned that there is an agent involved, you're not sure exactly who it is. There's a few people that it could be, that type of thing. So like, there's just enough of little pieces along the way to keep that suspense going, as well as you having a lot of fun along the way. And I have to bring up before I forget to, because I mentioned the, obviously the drunk driving and the arrest and dealing with the police after that, and then being in the car with the kidnappers. Another scene that just had me in stitches though is that auction scene.
Oh yeah.
Like that, like once he discovers that he basically needs to find a different, an alternative way out of that setting.
Yeah.
His actions and the way he goes about it is just bananas. And like, I just loved every minute of that, like trying to figure out like, well, that didn't work. He needs to like kick it up even a more of a notch. Like, what's he going to do next? What's he going to say next? And like, I loved that about it as well. So, and I think you're right. Like, I think Cary Grant and Ava Marie Saint had a great interaction relationship between each other. Like, you buy how it's kind of going back and forth as you do. Like, it's very akin to what you see in so many Bond films, right? Or so many films like that, where you have James Bond and whatever girl that he's falling for in that film, or even in non-James Bond films. Like, that is like a something that I don't know how often it happened before this, but it definitely happens a whole lot after this that we see in our lifetime from film. And I think that's just another aspect that makes this film enjoyable overall.
Yeah. Because at first, you know, I'm like, okay, he's attractive. I get like why she would, maybe she's just kind of into this type of thing. And then of course there's more to it. And then, and how it goes from there. But also I that's the thing too, is I felt like all the actions here were believable in the situation. And you also understand why they wouldn't believe him, because it is crazy and they covered their tracks really well. So I think that was another thing, that the character's actions here all made sense. I mean, maybe you could argue when he goes to the hotel room and he kind of pushes his luck, but you could also see it. And it was pretty convenient when the guy gets a knife in the back and he like pulls it out. Like, but again, I think like those things, I was so with it, the movie, I was willing to go with it. So that's, you know, that's what though like there were perhaps some convoluted elements, everything was believable. Everything I think made sense. Like, you understood why certain things were happening, the motivation.
Yeah, you can
just how crazy things get.
Yeah, you could probably say the same thing about when he goes back to the house the second time.
Yeah,
to like with the police officers or whatever, and everything's changed and nobody's there and this, that, and the other. It's like, it's another thing that maybe you could poke holes in, but like I feel like if you're just like along for the ride, it works fine. And it didn't bother me at all. Like, I love those interactions with all the different people. You know, we didn't mention a whole lot of the extras, I guess, in this, but a couple notables, specifically Martin Landau showing up in this one as the sidekick to Philip Van Damme, who's I guess the main quote unquote villain. So those, it's basically James Mason and Martin Landau as like the two guys that they're trying to take down. I thought that was interesting. Like, I saw that his name popped up in the credits at the beginning, and then I was like trying to place him. And at first I wasn't sure, you know, if I was going to recognize him as many years younger as he was than what I was used to him looking like. But he definitely has, this is one of his first major roles too, I believe.
Yeah, I didn't know. Like, he looked familiar, but I just couldn't place it. I'm like, oh wow. That's the only time I've ever seen. I didn't know he was ever young. I thought he was always older. I never, but
right. There's also a number of voice actors in this that are more classic voice actors or things of that nature. So Sarah Berner, who was actually one of the, she was in Rear Window as well. She was one of the married couples with the beds or whatever. Mm-hmm. She plays the telephone operator. She did a bunch of voice, kind of classic voice work. Les Tremaine is the auctioneer. Olan Soule is the assistant auctioneer who plays, is it Superman or Batman that Soule plays in a lot of the, he does the voice of one of those guys in a lot of the classic like Super Friends series as well. So like there's a couple cool things like that. We got our Hitchcock cameo obviously right away in the credit sequence. The bus being, or the, is it the bus door that gets shut right in his face or something? What other Hitchcock things did you pick out of this one? As you mentioned in kind of one of your intro statements, like this has a lot of what we've looked at throughout these films. So like how many did you pick out?
Well, yeah, the relationship with the mother, you know, Roger Thornhill, he has actually a pretty like healthy relationship with his mom. So that's a big key one. Of course, you have the Hitchcock blonde with Marie Saint. The falsely accused, probably the one that hits the falsely accused the most so far, since 39 Steps, of course. We have the cameo. I don't think of any, are there any other specific notable Hitchcock.
I didn't know this going into it, but just in doing a little bit of reading afterwards, so it was so subtle that I didn't pick up on it, but we have seen this now in like probably three of the films at least. But Martin Landau said that in an interview, basically that he was playing Leonard as subtly homosexual as far as his character goes. So we've seen that in at least three films now, which I did not pick up on, but I guess that's one of the reasons why he's so like wanting to get Ava Marie Saint out of the picture and things of that nature, and why he's got a little bit more like stake in what's happening. So I thought that was interesting. I didn't read into that or catch that on the watch, but now that I read it after the fact, I can kind of see where that was. And I guess Hitchcock was and the screenwriter were fine with it. They were actually big fans of it. The screenwriter actually even rewrote a line to like say something about his woman's intuition. There's a line in there that drops, which at the time I guess was not something that you would find guys like saying even in jest. Yeah. So that, I found that interesting as well.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense. I didn't catch that. I mean, obviously, it was very obvious, far more obvious than something like Rope.
Mm-hmm.
Now that you say that, a lot of those scenes, because their relationship was a bit weird. Not weird isn't the right word, but I did feel like there was something more there. At first, I thought he was going to, I don't know, maybe burn on him or something like that. And especially when he shoots the gun at him, and then obviously it ends up being blank. So. But yeah, that certainly opens the eyes.
Yeah, that was interesting
too. They missed it. Yeah,
the use of you bringing up that gun reminded me too that like another thing that kind of keeps you a little bit on your toes throughout the film, even with all the comedy, is the times that they're employing that gun in two different instances where you may be thinking that somebody's dead or something like that, where they have some little swerves there as well. So I thought that was kind of well done. On top of that.
He also loves his trinkets. Of course, we've had the lighter in the past. In this one, we get the matchbook becomes a really important piece. So that I didn't. I figured it would come up again. You know, it's the Chekhov's matchbook. You know, but that's another one too, because he loves those little things that always, something with matches and matches, keys, lighters. There's always something. Yeah,
that's kind of an interesting thing to kind of watch for. Obviously, this one is well received, right? It has like a 97% on Rotten Tomatoes, good reviews on a lot of top lists and things of that nature. Box office wise, I believe it did okay. I don't have the exact numbers on. Let's see, it grossed 46,000 first week, 35,000 second week, about 2.5 million in the first couple months. So according to MGM records, the theatrical rentals, 5.7 million and 4.1 million elsewhere. So it profited a decent amount, would have profited more, but apparently there was a bunch of delays in the filming, and Cary Grant had it in his contract that if it took more than a certain amount of time, that like it went into like some type of penalty phase and he would get paid an extra $5,000 a day for every day past whatever the threshold was. And they were at that before they started filming. So he basically made that like every day of the filming. And like, I think they said he made $500,000 just from this film. So I guess good on him for having a well-written contract. But yeah,
it's interesting because this is 7 years after this is his last movie. Like this is 1959 and he stops making movies in 1966. So
he made enough on this one. He didn't need to do
it. Yeah, I guess. Well, yeah, he said he retired and I guess for his family reasons and stuff like that. And other, like,
yeah. His daughter was born.
Issues with also he felt, I guess there's a big thing about how he felt the golden age of Hollywood was over. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons. I just found that really fascinating that I didn't realize he stopped making movies relatively young. Like he didn't die until the 80s. So he's
right.
It was a long time. And
sounded like there was some efforts from a few people to get him involved in. Like, I know I read something that said Hitchcock was trying to get him involved in something. There was
Shakespeare, Hamlet, or something. I forget.
And then like something else too. There was a couple other people that really wanted him to be involved with stuff, but he stuck to his word, I guess, since he made the statement that he wasn't gonna come out of retirement, even if he wanted to. I guess he was too stubborn to do that at that point, or whatever. I'm not sure. Interesting note too. Ava Marie Saint is still alive.
Really?
Yeah, she's 100. Wow. So she's 100. She turns 101 on July 4th this year. So I thought that was bananas. You're watching all these films, and obviously this one's a little bit later than some of the other ones we watched, because now we're up to 1959, and we started decades before that. So it just kind of, I guess, I forgot that we're moving forward in time, and that there was a possibility that any of the people we were watching on the screen were still alive. But Ava Marie Saint is, so I find that fascinating. And I did not catch the fact that apparently she appeared on a couple of the different like Academy Awards telecasts within the last 5 or 10 years. I think within the last 5 years, like she either presented something or some type of appearance. Within the last 5-10 years, I don't know exactly what it is, but
yeah.
She
has credits. Like she was looking, I don't know. There's a radio play revival that she did again. I don't know if it's like old, not footage, but like old, recordings that they're using, but she's accredited as early as 2022. So,
and she did, she did some voices on The Legend of Korra from 2012 to 2014 for 6 episodes. Like, wow, what a career!
Yeah, like, and she was Martha Kent in Superman Returns. I didn't remember that at all, but wow, yeah, it's crazy
learning something new every day.
Yeah, she's great in this too. We haven't mentioned her, but she's a huge part of this movie, and I do like her character and just the different, like her, the trajectory of her character is quite crazy, right? Because at first she just seems like this person who's enamored with Cary Grant, then she's a spy, but then she's a double agent, but she nailed it. Like she was, I believed every portion of it. I thought she was charming, and you could understand why Cary Grant was so enamored with her. And just like Grant, she was funny. She was terrifying when she needs to be. I thought she was she matched Cary Grant, which is not an easy thing to do. So certainly deserves praise as well. Because big reason why the movie works.
I agree with that 100%. And another thing that I wanted to mention, we talked about all of the things like the Hitchcockian themes to this film. It's crazy that it has all of those things that we've pointed out through the process of some of these other films. Yet it's probably one of the only ones that's not based off of anything. Which is almost something we've seen in every single one. This is not based off of a play. This is not based off of a short story. It's not based off of a novel. Like the screenplay was written by a guy that was working in conjunction with Hitchcock. And it's the seeds of this film are bananas, because it sounded like, from what I read, that they literally, whether it was Hitchcock's idea or Ernest Lehman's idea, I think it was Hitchcock's idea that he wanted to have some type of film that involved a chase across Mount Rushmore, and like that's what they started with. They wanted that, and then they built this whole movie around it, and then at some point they did come into contact with some type of journalist or something who had told him a story about, you know, these fake agents that don't really exist that were being used, and then that kind of like wove its way into the story. So I guess it was a little bit based on this story from the journalist. But yeah, it's like they wanted to do a sequence with the Mount Rushmore, and they wanted to do a sequence with the United Nations or something like that. Like they had a couple sequences in mind, and then they wanted to just build a fun film around it. And I know I read one Hitchcock quote that said, like, basically he had just done Vertigo, which obviously had a little bit more of a deeper tone and more serious sense to it. And it's, I think the quote said something along the lines, and I'm paraphrasing here, but that he wanted to just make a film that was fun entertainment that didn't contain as many of like the messages that he maybe was trying for in other films. Like he just wanted a fun romp of a film. And I would say if that was his goal, he succeeded.
Definitely. Like I mentioned, I felt like this was a summer blockbuster before summer blockbusters existed, and, you know, or a James Bond movie before James Bond movies existed. And I think you could even say maybe there were deeper messages here if you were to look hard enough, just like with elements of the Cold War, but those were, like we mentioned, it wasn't even like it was going deep on those. It was just needed something there. So yeah, it's, I think with compared to something like Rear Window, where there's much more to dissect regarding like what it's saying, I don't think this is necessarily like you said, he's not trying to say anything with it, which is fine. It's just a really enjoyable film that is, you know, I think if you were going to watch your first Hitchcock movie, I think this is a good one to start with, because I think it would appeal to people that maybe don't even love like enjoy classic movies as much. I think it's a good gateway Hitchcock, as they say.
It's very accessible for sure. Yeah. And the other thing that he was going for in this film was like he wanted it to have like a lot of different scenic things, a lot of different places that they stopped along the way. I think at one point they were supposed to have a showdown in Alaska. I don't think that made the final cut. And there was another interesting thing. You know, Hitchcock, I guess, has some grand ideas, but there's a screenwriter that was talking about this, and basically they said that Hitchcock had the idea of the hero being stranded in the middle of nowhere, but suggested that the villains try to kill him with a tornado. And Lehman was like, but like, how are they going to work up a cyclone? Like, how can they, like, how can we attribute a tornado to them? And I guess that's what eventually led them to the cyclone becoming the crop duster plane and led to that sequence. So, I mean, yeah, think big, like, no problem.
then they eventually made that movie, and it was Sharknado, so
he was just way ahead of his time.
Yeah, exactly.
Any other thoughts, trivia, tidbits, or things you haven't been able to bring up about North by Northwest?
No, I think we covered everything I had.
Yeah, I think, like, I don't know. Like, for me, this is, regardless of how my ranking shakes out when I go to rank Hitchcock, I don't know if any film is going to be more fun than this one. Like, this is Hitchcock having a whole lot of fun, and it definitely translates onto the screen. So I just was not expecting that, and I think it was not necessarily a breath of fresh air, because everything else has been good too, but it was just like a nice change of pace, I guess, in a way. Like, it was nice to see, like, just the comedy and just, like, Cary Grant's so amazing in this, and just like to let him just go. Like, I guess he didn't really like the film, and he didn't like the script, because he was probably used to like serious stuff, and like he thought it wasn't going to work. But I don't know. Like, he seemed like he was just like Hitchcock just unleashed him and let him do his thing, and it worked in spades for me.
Yeah. Well, he did vaudeville. He did some, you know, His Girl Friday. So he did comedy before, but
yeah,
you know, maybe at this point, I don't know. But I mean, he liked it enough, at least, to work, maybe just because of the money, but he worked with Hitchcock again after this, at least.
Yeah, so that's true. And apparently, like, Hitchcock had always wanted Cary Grant in this role for this film, but they were discussing it while Hitchcock was filming Vertigo, and I guess he had, like, told Jimmy Stewart a bunch about, like, what they were doing for this film and whatever, and Jimmy Stewart assumed that he was going to get cast in it. And it took a while for Hitchcock to realize that by having all these conversations that he had led him on. So I guess he waited until Jimmy Stewart was cast in another film and then offered him this role, knowing that he couldn't take it. so that he would turn it down and then he could give it to Cary Grant without upsetting either person, since he's had both of them in like what, three or four movies a piece. So
yeah,
that's interesting too. But a lot of little tidbits about this film that are fun. So next time we're going to be going a little bit of a different route, because the next one up on the docket is Psycho. Dan, what's your experience with Psycho, and are you looking forward to going at it again here?
This is sad. So this is a first time watch for me, kind of, because I have watched the Gus Van Sant Psycho. So I'm sorry. When it came out, actually wasn't, I see it in theaters. I saw it like when it was on Stars or something like that. And at the time I had no idea it was like a shot for shot remake of the regular Psycho. So I've never seen the original Psycho. So I'm glad to do that. But I'm a little worried that seeing the remake might ruin it a bit. I mean, at this point, even before that, I knew Psycho is one of those movies that's so much in the public conscience, it's not
right.
Going to surprise me. But I am interested in watching it, though, because even like a movie like North by Northwest, which I've seen before, there was a lot that I was able to pick up on. So I'm excited to see Psycho, the real Psycho, for the first time.
There we go. It'll be a first-time watch for me as well. Amanda's seen bits and pieces of it, so she, or at least most of it, I don't know if she's seen it all the way straight through, or at least not recently, so she's looking forward to it. This is the one she's actually been looking forward to these last two, probably the most, Psycho and Birds. So she's definitely going to have fun watching those alongside me. So so Psycho will be up next, then we'll finish with the Birds, and then we'll have a special episode where we do some Hitchcock awards and things of that nature before we move on to the next thing on our docket. So all right, that does it for this episode. Tune in next time for another chance to listen to more Cinema Geeks.